So we spent some time last week talking about some of this. We talked about what love looks like in the home. And today I want to just touch on a few more things that are commanded to us in Scripture or given to us in Scripture. But they're the things that not only are just commands, they are the things that generate healthy relationship, or you want to be more specific, these are the kinds of things that make a woman adore her husband. And they're just very straightforward in the Scripture. It's not complicated. It's just the fact of doing it as God has called you to. When you do that, if all things being equal, if there aren't sort of major background issues, these are the things that are going to at least cause your wife to admire you, and from that admiration, hopefully love you. As I said, there are other complications sometimes. There's some past hurts, some unforgiveness that might linger that make that still difficult. But as you address those and get past those, the way to move forward beyond, you know, sort of resolving those past hurts is just the daily commitment to certain principles that are there in Scripture. So, as I said, we spent some time last week talking about loving. Today I want to cover hopefully two more aspects of what it means to be a one-woman man. And again, I'm just going to reiterate, this is not so much your sort of commitment to abstain from any unhealthy relationships. This is your commitment to invest in your current relationship, invest in your home, and so generate the kind of love, or if you want to use the word romance, the kind of satisfaction in your relationship that creates a hedge that makes really any other relationship not that alluring, because you have so much bliss in your current relationship. And again, as I said, there's no secret sauce here. This is just following the Lord's command. And by the way, as always, you know, you guys are always welcome to ask questions along the way. I'm not great about soliciting them, but feel free to slip your hand up along the way. But getting back to the material, or back to the lesson, leadership. We spent some time talking about love last week. I want to touch really quickly on leadership. If you're around here, you hopefully have heard this a number of times. Leadership is servanthood. This is according to Jesus' command. He said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and the greatest ones exercise authority over them, but it will not be so among you. But whoever among you would be great must be your servant, and whoever would be first must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus himself gives the definitive lesson on leadership, and he defines it as slavery. We translate it servanthood, but it really should be translated slavery here. Leadership is enslaving yourself to the interest and the needs of the people that you're trying to lead. And as I said, if you're around this church for a while, you hopefully will hear that. I was talking to my son just a few weeks ago about a number of things, and we were talking about leadership. And this is my younger son, and he was saying that he was awakening to the fact that leadership required some sort of assertiveness and some sort of decision making. And he was like, yeah, like I never really got that, I felt like, growing up. And I was like, well, I'm sorry, but I mean, I feel like I've talked about, you know, making tough decisions and encouraging him to have courage in his convictions and all those other things. But I could understand, at least, that maybe I overcompensate sometimes, putting the emphasis more on servanthood than anything else. but because I think that's where the scripture is. But thankfully, when Jesus gives this model, he talks about making yourself a servant to others. He presents himself as the model of this. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So he defines his coming as this very thing, and even sort of summarizes it as giving his life. That's the way that he summarizes this sacrificial leadership model. But if you want to really get into the nuts and bolts of how it's fleshed out, just look at his life. His life was a continual existence of giving. He gave himself and gave himself and gave himself. So what did that look like in the life of Christ? Well, we don't know the particular details. We don't have a detailed description of, you know, how he woke up and, you know, brushed his teeth every day and or whatever it might be. We only have sort of vignettes along the way. There's not a whole lot that tells us about the routines of mealtime or any of those things. We assume that he was helpful and considerate during all those times, but we also know that servanthood involved a lot of teaching, involved a lot of confronting, and a lot of directing. So when we talk about servanthood, this is not necessarily meaning that you just sort of retreat into the background. I got some tape here. Excuse me, I'm going to have to pull this up because it's going to bother me. Richard, I don't know if that was your standing spot on Sunday morning, but I just moved it. So I think it used to hold a cord, but it's like that one little, the princess and the pea, you know, the little thing in my shoe that I was like, I can't teach with this thing under my foot. So Jesus presents himself as the model of this leadership, and he presents his life as giving up himself, in spite of the fact that most of what we see recorded in the pages of Scripture is what you might traditionally associate with leadership. It's standing in front of people sometimes. If not standing in front of large groups of people, it's taking a group of disciples along with him down the pathways of life and talking to them about the lessons of life. Or it is going sometimes into the theater of or the marketplace of Jerusalem and confronting the immoralities of the day, driving out, in some cases, money changers. So all those things manifest themselves in Jesus' life, even though he's the one who's telling us that this leadership is servant leadership. So how do you sort of think that through? Well, it really comes down to motive. It's all about motive. Why are you doing those things? The things that you do outwardly when you are exercising spiritual leadership may, in their role, have a lot of overlap with any other sort of model of leadership that you might find in the world. The key difference is motive. You're doing this not for yourself. You're doing this not for your own self-satisfaction or your own self-comfort or your own self-glory. Self is eliminated from the picture. You are, as Jesus says, giving up yourself. And you can give up yourself in small ways by, cleaning up the last dishes in the sink before you go to bed at night. Or you can give up yourself in big ways by setting aside your desire for personal reputation and being willing to stick your neck out on a difficult issue. Or setting aside your desire just to be the fun guy and being willing to say the difficult things. There's all kinds of ways that you can set aside yourself, but the key point of leadership that Jesus is emphasizing is the giving up or the sacrificing of yourself. the laying down of self-interest. And so this is what Jesus tells his disciples they have to do. This is where the difference is between the kings and the pharaohs and the emperors of that day who lorded it over those. When he says they lorded it over, he's really talking about they made certain sort of self-centered demands that were oriented towards their own honor, towards their own comforts. Sometimes, as a leader, you have to endure dishonor and disrespect and not take personal offense to that, because that's really not what the whole deal is about. The whole deal is not about your personal honor and respect for you per se. Now, respect for you might be necessary for the structure of the organization or for the order of the particular environment that you're in. There has to be order in corporations and businesses and workplaces, as well as in churches and in homes. There has to be someone at the end of the day who shoulders the responsibility of making hard decisions or bearing the weight of the criticism that comes after those decisions. That's necessary and good and right. And so in those cases, there has to be certain amounts of recognition for who is bearing that weight, who is going to ultimately be the person who bears the criticism when something goes awry. And that demands hierarchy. It demands recognition of whoever makes that call. And we might term that respect. We might term that honor. But it's not so much about you as it is about the functioning of the organization. You take that into the home, the same thing's true. You have certain elements where the home, in order to operate, has to have somebody who's going to make sometimes the tough decisions and tough calls, but they also sort of bear the weight of the blame, and they take it. They don't shift the blame. They don't hide from the blame. They take it when the tough things go bad. And that has to be a responsibility that you bear. Now, this is never more evident than raising a teenage kid who wants to make call all the shots but bear none of the responsibility. And they do. Sorry, no offense to teenage kids in here. Not looking at anybody. But this is the prototypical problem. You know, people wanting to grow up, they want to be adults, they want to have the sort of freedoms to do that, and they want to make the calls that they want to. You know, they want to drive that vehicle, and they want to drive it wherever they want to drive it, whenever they want to drive it, with whoever they want to drive it with. And you are there saying, well, no, but I pay the insurance rate on that, and not to mention holding the title on that, and, you know, bearing the responsibility if there's a crash to pay the hospital bills and to nurse you back to health or whatever it might be. You're thinking through the responsibilities, and so you're going to make the call on that, and you're going to bear the responsibility of that call. And so that calls for a certain amount of respect, but it's really not about you. I mean, it's not there. You're not there offended because someone is not sort of bowing down, kissing your toes. You're just thinking order, structure. And so I'm going to demand a certain amount of respect of my mandate here. That's leadership that's not self-oriented. It's leadership that's not operating for your own aggrandizement or your own sort of satisfaction, your own comfort. In fact, more times than not, it's very uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable. It's putting you in a place where you have to have some sleepless nights, where you have to cry yourself to bed because, you know, you've had so much conflict, but the conflict was necessary. Necessary in order to lead. Those are in themselves sacrifice. Those things are a form of laying down yourself. Now, on top of that, you have all the daily stuff as well. It's getting up normally, maybe for in my home, I normally get up before my wife. But it's getting the coffee pot ready. Making sure I go into the kitchen and if there are dirty dishes, I try to clean them up so that she wakes up to a clean sink when she gets up. It's trying to be the guy who is taking out the trash without having to be asked, because I know she doesn't enjoy doing that. So I just want to make sure that it's just never something she has to deal with. So it's everything from the hard conversations down to the small things in life. But this, all this stuff is sort of underneath this rubric of servanthood. This is what leadership looks like. And in the normal course of life, you're going to probably have on balance more of the taking out the trash, hopefully, doing the little things without being asked to do them just because you're trying to serve those who are in your household. And occasionally you have the big things. But it's going to be noticed because it's a daily element of your life. It's not just appearing every 3 months or 6 months or only during crisis times. It is woven into the fabric of the way that you live your life. You are just serving other people. You take that and you establish it in the home. It manifests itself in the church. It manifests itself in the neighborhood and in the society around you, because it becomes a part of your character. So when Jesus talks about leadership, this is what he's talking about. This kind of servanthood. Whoever would be great among you must be your slave. J. Oswald Sanders talks about leadership. He says, at the outset of any study of spiritual leadership, this master principle must be squarely faced. True greatness is found in giving yourself, not in coaxing others to serve you. True service is never without cost. It often comes with a painful baptism of suffering. But the true leader is focused on the service he can render to God and to other people, not on the residual perks of high office or holy title. So that's really what Jesus is getting at, this focus on providing for others, or really providing the environment so that other people can flourish. I find myself sometimes thinking about this in terms of my home, like a bit of a gardener, if you will, who is tending to the soil of my household, wanting to make sure that it has everything that it needs, that is protected from the pest and the environment that would potentially destroy it, making sure that it's watered and fertilized and tilled and the weeds are pulled out. And that's not always easy. I'm doing a little gardening right now, and making sure that all those environments are right is constant. And even with all that constant effort, you still can't keep everything away. But that's the way that I think about it. It's really not about sort of self-serving, but it's just making sure that I have the environment, that I'm creating the environment where my wife, first and foremost, can flourish, and my kids can flourish. That she has if it's a greenhouse, during the cold seasons, if it's proper sunshine during the warm seasons, if it's the proper amount of watering, as I said, the right balance of soil or all those other things. So in my life, that's what I want. I want to create an environment where my wife and my kids will flourish. And that is, in some cases, giving the appropriate comforts, so that they're not continually stressed out and unable to sort of find the quiet time that they need to either seek the Lord or to dwell with one another. Or, in some cases, it is giving them the right amount of responsibility and challenge so that they dig their roots deep like they need to. You can actually kill a plant by overwatering it. You can kill plants by over-tilling the soil, by, you know, constantly trying to dig up everything around them. You do damage to the roots of the plant. So there's all kinds of balance that you have to bring to this. But again, the whole environment, it's like it's not about you. It's about watching that plant grow, which is typically, you know, what brings the satisfaction to the gardener. Is not so much even the fruit that you get out of it, but just the joy of seeing the garden and the plants flourish. Well, you have the joy of seeing your wife, your kids flourish whenever you're providing that kind of safe environment for them to grow up spiritually. So this is how we have to orient ourselves in our leadership. Men, for whatever reason, have a hard time thinking about this way. They think about their life, and they sort of narrow it down to one or two checked boxes. Like, kind of like the rich young ruler when he comes to Jesus and he says, you know, what do I have to do to enter the kingdom of heaven? And you remember Jesus gives him some of the Ten Commandments, goes through the list of things that you're supposed to do, and the rich young ruler says, well, you know, I did all those. What else? And so Jesus tells them what? Love your neighbor as you would yourself. And tells them to go sell everything he has first. And when he doesn't do that, then he turns around and tells this parable about loving your neighbor. And that sort of goes beyond sort of the checkbox to help him understand, no, this is comprehensive. This is all of life, that you have got to be others-oriented. And the guy goes away very sad. Well, sometimes husbands can fall into that same pattern. Like, what do I need to do to be a husband? Give me the list. Well, I got to go to work. I got to earn a paycheck. I got to do a little yard work. Oh, yeah, I can take the trash out. I can do this or do that. They check those boxes, and then after they check those boxes, they're done. Now they can go sit in their recliner and, you know, watch their sports game or whatever. But this that Jesus is talking about is comprehensive. A slave, that's a comprehensive concept. It's all the time. Slaves don't work 9 to 5. They work 24/7. So you are enslaving yourself to the needs of your family 24/7. And whatever the demand is, you're ready to do it. That means after 12-hour workday, you're sort of slugging home, dropping, you know, your backpack at the door, and you come in to chaos, and the kids are going berserk, and your wife has pulled her hair out, and you are tired, but at that point you got to pick it up and you got to do another hour or two of hard work parenting. You do it because it's sacrifice, and you do it from the loving care of God's love within you. So this is leadership that Jesus defines it. It's laying down yourself. It's being completely unself-oriented. And when you do that, as I said, this daily aspect in your life, it's going to show up in the big times, in the crunch times. But it's going to be seen more on a daily basis in the servanthood. When you do that, it will generate respect. It will generate honor from your wife. She will see it if it is consistent, if she knows that it's there. And by the way, this is also relational. It's not just the things that you do. It's also being attentive to what her needs are. And sometimes those needs are conversational. Sometimes those needs are emotional. And so just realizing, you know what, I'm a little tired. I'm a little bit sort of distracted right now, but I need to focus in because this is really not about me. I need to focus in on what my wife needs and pay a close attention. I need to listen to what I hear coming from her heart and really dial in to make her the focus of my time this evening or this hour or whatever it might be, because it's not about me. Yeah, you're tired. We're all tired. Yeah, you're a little bit sad. We're all a little bit sad sometimes. Yeah, it's stressful, whatever you're going through at work. Everybody deals with the stress. Get over it. Just get over it. Because it's not about you. You got to dial in to her. So this is all within the umbrella of servanthood. This is, again, me kind of talking back to my 22-year-old son, and saying, in case I missed something there, it's all of life, okay? Leadership is being willing to lay aside yourself in the little things and in the big things, in the daily acts of service, and in the high calling of courage in the moments of crisis. It's being willing to do whatever you have to do to provide the environment for the people that you're leading to flourish. Now, let me move from that to another element. So we've talked about love. We talked about leadership. Let me talk about provision a little bit, because this is also an aspect of being a husband. And I think it's an aspect of being a one-woman man. Again, we're reverse engineering this, if you will. We're talking about having your heart devoted to one woman, not out of a commitment of just excluding other women, but out of your commitment of being consumed and devoted with one woman. In other words, really sort of enthralled with your marriage relationship and providing an environment where she feels the same way. Well, that's going to happen when you're loving. It's going to happen when you're leading. And it's going to happen when you're providing. This is part of the call of headship in the home. Ephesians 5, verse 28. Husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church. So he uses a couple words here. Ektrephai is the word nourish, which basically means to provide food. That's his basic meaning here. To provide the essentials of life. When you nourish your own body, you're providing food for your body. It's fundamental to how you take care of yourself. And so it's very practical what God has called you to do here. He's called you to be one who provides, one who supplies or feeds for the essentials of life. And he doesn't give that responsibility, get this a little closer, he doesn't give that responsibility to your wife. He gives it primarily to you. You're the one who bears the burden as the provider in your home. God didn't create marriage as some sort of pragmatic relationship where you sort of weigh out all the options and you decide if your wife's a more capable provider than you, then you give her that role, because that's sort of the way you guys balance it out. No, in the scripture, God gave that to husbands, not to wives. I've seen it a number of times through the years. I've encountered these couples who rationalize their way to some scenario where she can make more money, and so I'm going to be the stay-at-home, and I'm going to just raise our kids. And on paper, like I said, you can't argue with it. It's just cash in, cash out. But every single time that I've ever seen that, it results in problems. It results in problems because as the wife is bearing the burden of being the primary provider in the home, she also has a very difficult time allowing her husband to make the difficult calls when those difficult calls need to be made, especially when they involve finance and money. And so it builds a kind of resentment in her that she may not voice out in the open, or she might not voice for quite a long time. It could go a decade of slow building inside of her this kind of resentment that she has toward her husband trying to lead, trying to say the tough things when she's bearing all the burdens. Could be leadership as simple as Let's get up at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning so we can be ready to go to Sunday school. And she's thinking, you're not the one who's been getting up at 5 a.m. all week and getting home at 7 every night. I'm tired. I want to sleep. You get to do this every morning. She may process all that in her head without ever actually voicing it, but you feel the resistance. And you're just trying to lead your family. So you don't really understand sort of what's going on internally. You're just trying to do what's pragmatic, but you're undermining your marriage. God gave you the responsibility of providing just as much as He's called you to lead. And so you need to take it upon yourself to be the primary financial provider for your home, and don't cast that burden on your wife. I happen to believe that God didn't design your wife to bear that burden, that He designed you to bear that burden. As men, He designed us to bear that burden, both physically, if you will, if you're doing something that requires more physical labor, and even emotionally, the ability to process things. Men just in general have an ability to process stress and the strains of work in a way that doesn't linger as much as it does sometimes with your wives. And so you're more equipped to do this. Now, I am not saying that your wife can't work. Don't misunderstand me here. What I'm saying is that you need to be the primary provider. And by that, what I typically mean, what I try to explain to people is you need to be providing for your home in such a way that if your wife was ever put in a place of jeopardy at her place of work, you could tell her in a snap, just leave. We don't need the income. We can survive without your income. If your wife is in a place, an environment where her boss is harassing her, you don't want to have to say to your wife, I hate that, man. I'm sorry that he's talking to you that way, but you got to keep going because we got to have the money. No, you're not protecting your wife at that point. You want to be able to say to her, you know what? Leave. We don't need that income. My income is enough to meet our basic needs. I mean, my income provides our housing. It provides our food. It provides our health care. It provides our transportation. Those are, if you want to sort of break it down, maybe the core essentials, and maybe clothing, you know, whatever kind of little bit of clothing you might have to put into the budget. So I can meet all those basic needs and hopefully a little bit more on my income. There are a lot of other things that you spend money on. Vacations, perhaps fancier clothing that you might wear otherwise, or some other things like that. Those can be added benefits that might come from additional salary from your wife. But you never want to put yourself in a position where you're so dependent on your wife's income that you could never just tell her, stop. I mean, if it's hurting her spiritual life, if it's hurting your home life, if it's hurting her in some sort of material, physical way, if it's hurting her in sort of emotional ways, you want to be in a position to tell your wife, we don't need it. We don't need the income. So just come home and be at home, or, you know, find some other work if you have to find some other work, whatever it might be. So when I talk about bearing the burden of providing, that's what I'm talking about. There are balancing perspectives in the Scripture. Everything from a diligent, godly woman in Proverbs 31 who we see with an entrepreneurial spirit is going out and in some cases starting a small business of selling clothing, or in some cases going out and even buying real estate. She goes out and buys a plot of land and makes a profit by selling it. So she is sort of an ancient world real estate agent. So we see women doing that in the Scripture. Yes, Jonathan?
If a family has found themselves in that predicament, and a lot of families nowadays need two incomes to provide even sometimes the basics, especially as housing is out of control now, how would you counsel them in trying to get back to being the primary?
Well, my first point would be to go to the definition of need. You say they need two incomes. Let's talk about need. What are those needs? And when you list out the budget, I guess I should say for the sake of the recording, you're asking me how would you counsel in the modern environment where it seemingly takes two incomes to survive, how would you counsel a couple, they're in that situation, they think that they need these two incomes to survive, how would you counsel them? Well, I would start with a point of need and say to them, do you really need that? I mean, let's look at the discretionary spending to begin with. And most people have quite high discretionary spending. They probably don't budget to begin with. They don't know how much discretionary spending they have, but when you peel it back, you can look at the number of times that they're eating out, the number of times they're seeking outside entertainment. You can look at the kind of services that they are subscribed to at home. Do they really need all those services? And then you get to other what are considered to be, in some cases, necessities, but you kind of question whether they're necessities. Do you need two cars? Do you really need that kind of car? So for me, practically, just to let you know what that meant in my home, I have four kids. We drove a Toyota Camry stick shift because that was the cheapest Camry we could buy. It's less expensive than an automatic, with cloth seats and no frills. We drove that Toyota Camry all the way up until our fourth child, the only car we had. We had three car seats across the back seat. And it's a lot of bending over, a lot of strapping in, a lot of disappointment when we don't have an extra seat to haul someone around. But that's what we had to do in order to keep our life trimmed and not put ourselves where we're overstretched. And only time that we got another vehicle, we got a used Honda minivan, was when we had our fourth child, because we needed, at that point, we literally needed another car, and a car that could haul six people. So I just go back to the point of need. Do you really need the Escalade? And does she need the Mercedes? You have two cars. We probably could consolidate some areas there. And do you need 3,500 square feet? Can you get by on 2,500 square feet? There's all kinds of questions of need that you have to ask yourself at that point. And while I can't talk about individual math, I can just tell you from my personal experience, I've never encountered that situation where the needs were all truly needs. They were a combination of wants along with needs. Same thing's true for us in our housing. I mean, we've always kind of kept our housing cost at a modest level of my income, not because we couldn't buy more, just because we were satisfied. We were content. We didn't need the nicest house. Sometimes, practically speaking, just to get to brass tacks, it's conversations with my wife. When we go to someone else's house and they have much grander and nicer things, and we come home and I can kind of sense something's going on in the car, I kind of get home and there's a little bit of a sort of down look, and I just ask her, what's going on? Well, such and such, they just did this new kitchen renovation, and it just was so nice being over there. Yeah, that was nice. But we have a sink and a refrigerator, and we have a stove, and we have what we need. And maybe one day we can do that kitchen renovation, but right now it would not put us in the healthiest financial place. So you have to have those difficult conversations. My kitchen is probably in some serious need of upgrading. It's a builder-grade kitchen from 1997 that we've got a couple of new appliances, but it's got all the same sort of countertops and all that other stuff. I'd love to have a kitchen upgrade, but I don't want to put myself in a position where it wouldn't be financially wise to do that. So it comes down to things like contentment. Do you really need those things? Because for me, it's more important not to put a burden on my wife where she would have to go out and have to help pay for some of that. Yes?
You touched on 1 Timothy 6 real quick. You just mentioned contentment, shepherding our hearts through what the needs are from the scriptures.
Yeah. So the question Robert's asking is 1 Timothy 6, where Paul says, is talking about his about not the love of riches is the root of all sorts of evil, and contrasting that with contentment. Godliness with contentment is great gain.
First, right before that, we have food and covering, these we shall be
content. Yeah. Yeah, I think that is, if you will, the I don't know what you, it's not, the word is not original sin, it's the big sin of probably our nation right now, materialism, that we live and breathe in a materialistic environment, and we allow ourselves to be influenced by that more than we should, and it comes in very subtle ways. It comes through the airwaves, just watching these commercials over and over again, who are fine-tuned to convince you that you need their product. I mean, I'm susceptible to it myself. For me, it's automobiles, I have to confess. I can be a car, electric car, but still, those are actually the more expensive ones, you know. I don't want to confess how many hours I spend drooling over an electric truck, but they're more than they should. I would love to have this really nice truck. I've never had a truck. Exactly. Who said that? Right there, brother. I'm a pastor. Why do I need a truck? If I had a truck, I'd be more tempted to do things I shouldn't be doing. So I got to bring myself back to that. I mean, I drool over this thing. I would feel, I don't know, maybe some deficiency in my manhood. But do I really need it? I mean, my car gets me from A to B. It's comfortable. It drives itself, too, which is nice. So there's all kinds of, I mean, I have to bring myself back to like, man, I'm really blessed. This vehicle that I have is solid and reliable and comfortable and all these other things. So we just have to kind of do that work in our heart to constantly confront ourselves on all of these things at every level, so that we don't stretch ourselves. And that allows us to be in a position to not put burdens on other people. First of all, not to put burdens on our wife, but not to put burdens on anybody else to backfill our life, and gives us the ability to give, to be generous to other people, to be able to, we have a missions giving going on right now, short-term missions giving. I would hope that it would be the goal of every family in our church to give something to our short-term missions, even if it's $25, $100, you know, just to be able to say, I participated in this work that the church is doing over and above my regular giving. But a lot of people don't have an extra $50 in a month to do something like that, because they have filled their life with 8 different streaming services and cars with massage seats and all this stuff that, like, do you really need that? Now, I have to say, ventilated seats probably is a that's probably reached a necessity for me, but you know, there are certain comforts of life. No, I joke about that sometimes. There after you get used to a certain lifestyle, it's hard to go back, and I have gotten used to certain luxuries, but I have to constantly remind myself that I don't really need that. But I want to put myself in a position that that I'm not so overstretched that I can't do all that. And getting back to the material, especially if it comes down to my wife and making her feel the burden. Now, for us, we've for the most part, most of our marriage, we've chosen a pathway where my wife just has not had outside income. She's pretty much been at home. That's brought joy to our life. That's not saying it's the right and only way to do it for everybody. She's always, Tara's always had sort of small side hustles, I should say. She's done little things along the way for some pocket money, and I've never minded her doing that. But we always wanted her priorities to be rightly aligned, beginning with her relationship with God, her relationship with me, her relationship with our children, her relationship with the church. And in my perspective, if all of those things are working properly, and then she has extra sort of capacity, if she wants to go out and do something else, I'm fine with that. But I don't want that something else to suddenly be put at the front of all those. I don't want her to say, well, my career is here, and then if I have some leftover emotional energy and some leftover time, then I might get around to, you know, doing what I need to do with our kids or doing what I need to do with my husband or spending time with the Lord. I want to make sure everything stays in its proper place. I often use concentric circles. You know, you got God at the center, husband, children, home, church, and then everything else that's out there. You got all those priorities that are in her life. And then, you know, along the way, my wife's done substitute teaching. We managed an apartment complex where she was doing a lot of the, you know, showing of the apartments. She does tutoring right now. She's always had a sort of little side something going on. And those are fine. But like I said, those things never enter into our life as primary sources of income. So I can just tell you that this is a constant source of generating esteem within our marriage. My wife is very grateful for the fact that I continually put her in that position, the position to have the freedom to pursue not only home, but ministry and people and, you know, and, you know, her spiritual life, and then to be able to choose to do the things she either loves to do or doesn't love to do after she has extra time. And by the way, not every woman is the same. I mean, we've had to talk through that as well. My wife is not, you know, she's not every other woman. And there are some women who are, they just built differently. They can just handle more. And some women are not. And that's another thing that you need to talk over with your wife. You know, don't compare yourself to someone else. Yes, they can do the same things that you can do in the home and in the church. And then on top of that, they can hold down, you know, maybe a full-time job or work 25 hours a week or something like that. But that's not a concern of mine, whether you're comparing yourself to someone else. I'm worried about you. And I'm worried about the way God's designed and made you and making sure that within the capacities He's given you, because He's not made me the same as everybody else. I can handle certain things and other people can handle other things. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, but it is, if you will, an ordering of responsibility and priority. And it begins with you. It begins with you saying, I'm going to provide. If I have to work one job, if I have to work two jobs. Early in my marriage, I'm trying to remember, I guess the first 6 years of my marriage, I had multiple jobs before I finally got to the point where I could have just one job to provide. I've been a pastor ever since I have sixth year of my marriage, and so, you know, full time in that. Although I've even had side hustles, you know, in the meantime, I've had some rental properties for a small period of time, which is like two full time jobs. That's why I got out of that.
How do you work two full time jobs and still have the time to be?
Well, that's why I got out of that. Yeah, it's tough. But sometimes, you know, if that burden had to be borne for the basic needs of the family, then I want to be the one that bears it. That's the bottom line. So it's getting my priorities right. It's getting my wife's priorities right. And then setting my life around that. And then that kind of commitment generates esteem. It makes your wife, it makes it at least easier. It doesn't guarantee she'll respect you, but it certainly makes it a lot easier for her to respect you. All right, we got more actually to talk about next week. So we'll come back and continue this talking about reverse engineering, a one-woman man. Thank you guys for your time. See you Sunday, Lord willing.